Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on Reentry, Employment, and Housing. It is January 19th, 2017, and this will be our final meeting of this task force in its current iteration. So glad to have everyone here who's here. I'm Michael Dembro. I'm the senator for District 23. That's northeast and southeast Portland. And to my left.
Oh, hello. I'm Lou Frederick. I'm a senator now for District 22. That's north and northeast Portland.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Serena Stoudemire-Wesley, Director of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in the Governor's Office.
Jim Booker, Oregon Employment Department.
Jen Netherwood, Pacific Northwest Carpenters Institute.
Brian Jed, Mercy Corps Northwest Reentry Transition Center.
I'm Ross Caldwell from the Criminal Justice Commission. I'm here for Mike Schmidt, who had a baby about a week ago, so he's
good for him.
Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner.
Okay, and yeah, hey, well, let's go to the people on the phone. And somebody's making a lot of noise, so if you're not speaking, could you put your phone on mute? Thanks. Okay, so who do we have on the phone? Okay, Paul. Great. Who else?
Elizabeth from Senator Denver's office. Hey.
Hi.
Sybil Hebbs from the Oregon Law Center.
Great. Anyone else on the phone? Okay, so who do we have in the audience? Let's start over there.
Hi, Kim Travis with Oregon Housing and Community Services.
Nova Sweet, FPP alum, and YWCA advocate.
Christy Van Order, all around busy body. Rick Martinez, just here to win her first time.
Okay, welcome. Glad you're here. Okay, so the first item that we have on the agenda, and we'll be spending the bulk of today's session going over the final report of the task force. Before we do that, I asked Sybil Hebb to come back and talk to us about the latest of what's going on the housing front in terms of our effort to facilitate housing for people in reentry. And you may recall that Sybil spoke to us, it was a while ago.
Very early on.
Yeah, and we talked about some changes based on Supreme Court rulings and the issue of Sybil, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and kind of recap what you told us last time and let us know what the latest is in terms of the way that people are, in this situation are to be addressed so that there's not a discrimination happening.
Great. And I just thank you so much for the invitation, and I thank all the committee members and folks who are interested in this for the work that you're all doing and for the time. I apologize for not being there in person. I had contradictory commitments in Portland, so apologize for that. Can everybody hear me okay on my phone?
Yeah.
Okay. So as we discussed briefly the last time I had the opportunity to speak with you all, there had been some very exciting developments from legal aid's perspective in the spring of 2015. And the two, sort of late winter, early spring of 2014, 2015, and the The two major occurrences were, number one, a Supreme Court, a U.S. Supreme Court decision that upheld the disparate impact analysis of whether or not discrimination has occurred. And what that meant was the Supreme Court upheld the theory that a rule or a practice that was neutral in policy or neutral on its face could be discriminatory if it had a disparate impact in application on a member of a protected class. What that means in the context of fair housing is that, for example, a landlord or a property management company could have a application screening policy or an eviction policy that was neutral on its face, but as applied, had disparate impact on people of color or other protected classes that are protected under the Fair Housing Act. And so that was very exciting. Oregon has a state statute that codifies our own disparate impact analysis that is consistent with what the U.S. Supreme Court held was viable. And so we sort of now have kind of double protection on that theory. What happened then a few months later was that HUD, the Housing and Urban Development Agency, issued an opinion letter that went out to all public housing agencies that basically said, here's what we think this analysis means in the context of certain housing application screening contexts. And that opinion essentially said a handful of things, the most salient of which are that with respect to certain populations, there is clear and specific evidence, unfortunately, tragically, that the criminal justice system has disparately impacted people of color. And there, it's clear that, and no secret to any of you, but this is the case. And so they found that based on that, a application screening policy that discriminated against, had a blanket ban against applicants with criminal history, was not going to survive a disparate impact analysis of discrimination. So they essentially issued an opinion letter to all of their public housing agencies saying, you must not have blanket criminal history bans on applicants. You must provide a individualized analysis and assessment. Doesn't mean that you can't ever consider criminal history, but you must provide that you must make sure that that's an individualized assessment so that you're looking at the particular type of criminal history and what its relevance is to whether or not someone would be a good tenant. You need to take into account certain considerations like how long ago was the history, what was the nature of the conviction or the crime, what evidence of mitigation has or rehabilitation is there since that time. And that was a theory or a practice that I think legal aid advocates for a long time have felt was the right approach. But this issuance from HUD was fabulous clarification and support of that analysis. And so that was the state of things, you know, as we moved into the fall. The election made a number of folks sort of question, with a new administration and a new director of HUD, was that analysis going to change, and were there going to be new developments that we were going to see? And so I think that brings us up to where we are now. And maybe I should stop talking and see if people have questions or if I'm giving you the right information.
So just based on the last point, Sybil, you're just leaving that as a question. We don't know what the future will be, but you've brought us up to where we are today. Is that right?
Yes. And yes, sir. And there is a group of housing justice advocates that has been meeting periodically via teleconference on a national basis, and I've been participating in those recall, our most recent one was on the 4th of January. And what I can update you based on that call about is that I think people are, recognizing that there's uncertainty. There's still a lot of question happening. But what we have, I think, fundamentally come back to is that regardless of where the new director of HUD may fall, and of course we don't know that, haven't time to learn and discover that information, but regardless of where that individual agency may go, the Supreme Court decision is solid. That was a 5-4 decision 2 terms ago. I don't think any of us feel like it's likely that that's going to change anytime soon. So that gives people a lot of comfort in terms of, we know what the direction is from the highest court in the nation for the very, long foreseeable future about that analysis. And if that analysis is protected and remains the way that we as attorneys and practitioners would look at these cases, I think it's hard to find a way for HUD to move backwards from what they laid out in their opinion letter. And I think it's states wouldn't be able to restrict, of course, what the Supreme Court has found. So the advice from the national advocacy, the legal aid and other policy experts on these issues has really been to focus on education about what the Supreme Court decision means, work with local public housing authorities to make sure that their policies and practices are compliant. We've begun the outreach to the local Oregon Housing Authority Association, and they have welcomed that, and so we're starting those conversations. And I think we're still kind of trying to learn a little bit about the nuances of how that standard will be implemented. But I think that's sort of, unfortunately, as much as I can say at the current,
mm-hmm. In the current situation. Yeah, well, thank you. So the HUD directive just applies to public housing, right? Public housing that has federal dollars. Does it apply to, yeah, okay.
That's correct. We do think that, essentially what the HUD directive, what the HUD opinion was, it was issued to the folks over whom HUD has authority, but really it was interpreting the Supreme, it was sort of saying, given that the Supreme Court has upheld this disparate impact analysis, and given that the Fair Housing Act applies public housing, we as overseers of public housing authorities are giving you some direction about what we think the Fair Housing Act means using a disparate impact analysis. So I don't think it's much different how it would play out in private housing or how the Supreme Court's decision impacts private landlords.
Mm-hmm. Shibble, this is Paul Solomon. I wonder, do you have any examples of this playing out in the private market here in Oregon? Are there any cases that have been taken against landlords that have appeared to take advantage of people because of their criminal histories and not rent to them?
There are no reported decisions on that analysis that I'm aware of in Oregon. However, given, since these decisions and the new opinion have come down, Legal Aid has worked with the housing authorities as well as landlord representatives to do education of members, including landlords, about what the new decision means. So, this is a priority issue for a lot of folks who are trying to make sure to get the word out and educate folks, and certainly from our offices, it's an issue that we think is, critically important to our clients. So we are, watching for those issues. And if someone were to come in looking for legal assistance, certainly something that we would take very seriously.
Yeah, super. Thanks.
Questions from the dais for Sybil? Anyone? Sybil, I don't know if you're aware of it, but a bill has been introduced. Actually, in a minute, we'll be going over the various reentry bills that are out there. But a bill was introduced by Representative Doherty, actually outside of our process here, that would prohibit landlords from evaluating the criminal history when doing a background check. Is your sense that would be necessary given the Supreme Court ruling?
Well, it's a good question, and we weren't aware. I saw the bill as it was published, and have looked through it, and very much appreciate the interest and instinct behind it. I think if I'm reading that bill correctly, it's essentially applying, I think, as you described, also a kind of a ban-the-box type of layer on housing applications, sort of similar to the legislation that Oregon passed a couple of sessions ago that applied in employment context. And so, as it's drafted, the bill prohibits the use of criminal history in an initial screening, but does not address how it be used or whether or under what circumstances it can be used after an initial screening. And I'm not an expert on how that would play out and probably haven't been able to give it enough attention since I've seen it recently, but a couple of questions would come up for me. And one is that I think it's hard to legislate in any context, I mean political or other practical considerations aside, I just think it's very difficult to draft something that would apply in any kind of detailed way and accurately reflect the full protection of the Supreme Court decision in a statutory fashion. So that's one kind of question I would ask. You could probably pass a statute that was drafted in a fairly general way that simply echoed that fair housing applications apply, that the disparate impact analysis applies in the context of screening, and that in considering any kind of criminal history, you need to assess the relevance of the behavior to the person's suitability as a tenant, plus any evidence of mitigation and rehabilitation or something like that, and that would probably be no narrower than a Supreme Court decision. You'd need higher minds than mine to figure that out. But the question that I would have around something that was simply banning the analysis in an initial screen is that really getting at what the HUD opinion is about? And I'm not sure if it does. And, if there are folks who are paying application screening fees at the get-go, who then get to sort of a second layer of analysis and are not considered, is there something to be thought about there in terms of how many application fees are being shelled out? And I'd want to look at that. I don't have a good answer on that.
Thank you. Any other questions, colleagues? Okay, well, thank you very much, Sybil.
Thank you all so much for your help.
Yeah, hey, Sybil, one question. So could you say a little more about the ongoing conversations with the the property managers, landlord associations? I remember when you came, there was a concern about how disparate impact potentially conflicted with equal opportunity. If you're treating cases in a case-by-case manner, is that opening you up for, you know, problems with inconsistency?
Well, that's a great question, and thanks for raising that. I think that that is a concern that, it's my understanding that that's a concern that some of the landlord associations have. I don't know, I couldn't hear all of the members of the audience, and I don't know if they're, you know, if Deborah or Jim or any of the other landlord folks are in the audience. So please interrupt me if so.
No.
What I can say from my prior conversations is that, that has been a concern. My feeling is that so long as the individualized assessment is done in a way that considers, criteria. You can have criteria that are the same. If they're applied against an individual set of circumstances, you may come up with different analyses. And as long as that's done with a respect to, sort of a relevant level of inquiry, my sense is that there's a way to make sure that you're balancing out those concern. I think there's a way forward there. I think that landlords may be nervous about whether or not they're always going to do that in a way that, meeting all of the considerations, and I can understand that concern. I think it requires a level of training and an education that may not currently be available or implemented for all landlords. But, I think it's critical to our communities that we've all grappled with this, and that, we appreciate the work of this group and continuing to discuss these, and Legal Aid remains interested in training and education, and I think a lot of it is going to, that's going to be a place where we're going to need to focus a lot of energy to help people figure out how to balance those considerations.
Right. Thank you.
Is there a more consistent way to do that, though, instead of just saying, shouldn't there be like a set criteria to make it more fair and more equitable?
Yeah, I would think so. But who creates those criteria is a question.
The HUD opinion letter does a good job of laying out a number. They're not prescriptive, but they set out a number of different criteria. I'd be happy to forward a link to that, and you may find it of interest.
Could you?
I can send that along to you all for review.
Yeah, that would be great. If you could send it to Cheyenne, then she can get it out to the rest of us.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Sybil. Thanks for
Thanks.
Getting on board.
Thank you all so much, and thank you, Chair, for the invitation. Thank you all for your work.
Of course, thanks. Okay. All right, so the next item is just an update on the legislative concepts that are out there with respect to reentry. And we have bill numbers. Can you put that up? Yeah. We have bill numbers. Some of these, I think about half of them, have already been introduced. They're pre-session filed. And then the other half are in the works and will be introduced, I think, on February 1st. So those of you who are up here should have it as a handout.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, members of the task force, the copy of the draft that was just handed out, this was also emailed, but within 20 minutes of the start of the meeting, probably. And it's been uploaded to OLIS, and it's available on the screen there. The list of bills there is sort of what was an offshoot of your activity, plus a few others that we found just searching through the bills that have been introduced so far. So it's probably not a complete list, but it's as close as we've got. So the typeface is really small on the hard copy because it includes a column for comments in the right that you should still be able to see, as well as on the screen. Did you want to go?
Yeah, I thought I would.
Okay. If you can see. Sorry about the orientation. That's where we have to have it. so that the media can broadcast it for the people who are watching remotely.
Right. So, you know, first of all, there are the bills that kind of came out of this task force, and they're all Senate bills because I put them in, so they started in the Senate. But all of them but one, have the four legislators as the chief sponsor. One of them, Senator Winters, has not listed as a chief sponsor because it's going to go to Ways and Means, and she's the chair of the relevant subcommittee, so she didn't want to have her name on. But the first two were both introduced through the Human Services Committee as committee bills, and the first one, Senate Bill 241, creates the Bill of Rights for the Children of Incarcerated Parents and establishes the Task Force on Children of Incarcerated Parents. And then Senate Bill 242 is the one that extends the life of the Family Preservation Project through funding. It appropriates monies from the general fund to Oregon Department of Administrative Services for the YWCA of Greater Portland to be expended for the Family Preservation Project. And I will say, just this morning, the co-chairs of Ways and Means released their budget, and I don't know if you saw it, but what that budget does is it's built on the programs that are legislatively in place. So they exist in statute, and what would it cost to continue them at their current statutorily approved level? And because the Family Preservation Project was part of what we familiarly call the Christmas tree at the end of the session, that has no life in statute. And so at this point, there is no funding for the Family Preservation Project. So it will be considered through this bill and then through the Ways and Means process. Senate Bill 682, this is Commissioner Carlson's bill, provides that the obligers in incarceration and release from incarceration are substantial changes of circumstances to modify or suspend orders for support of child, permits modifications or suspensions of support orders involving incarcerated obligers to be ordered retroactive to date of initial incarceration, to another date during incarceration when obliger is unable to pay ordered support, or to date that is 61 days following release from incarceration. Okay. I won't say that's clear as mud, but it is kind of technical. Janet, do you want to say something about it?
Yeah, this was relating to the concept or the idea, and we discussed it here and had some folks from Marion County's District Attorney's Office that work on child support that testified in front of the task force, that when a person goes into prison, and obviously their income changes substantially from what it was before they went into prison, unless they affirmatively put in the paperwork to modify their child support order, that child support continues to accrue throughout the time that they're incarcerated. So that's the first part of it. The second part is that when they are released, even if they've modified that order downward to the lack of income that they have when they're incarcerated, at the 61st day, it bumps back up to whatever level it was prior to going in, unless they file the appropriate paperwork. And that means they have to file the paperwork, and they have to do it right, and they have to do it timely. And those are kind of big lifts for people that are involved in the populations that we're talking about. So the concept was to fix that. I worked on language, sent it to Senator Dembro. He sent it into Legislative Council, and then as Legislative Council was almost wrapping up their work, I connected with Kate Richardson from the Department of Justice. You know, we had kind of weather issues and all that kind of thing, so it took a while to do that. And I learned a couple things. One is I learned that the federal rules no longer allow Oregon to do that 61st day piece where it automatically bumps back up. So Oregon will have to change its administrative rules anyway, and she's very excited to work with us on this bill to make that possible. Whether the language that Legislative Council came up with on this bill as it's been introduced is the language or not, the concept is sound. What I also learned is that the federal rules don't allow us to go retroactive. Once someone's in prison, say they've been in 3 months and realize that they should have done it, you can't make it retroactive back to the time that they were incarcerated. That violates federal rule. So I connected with her on email early this morning, and she has a work group that's working. She says that she thinks the best option is for a suspension approach with a rebuttable presumption of inability to pay, but they'll have a work group meeting tomorrow, and they'll provide amendments once the bill is before the committee, we'll move forward on that. But that's it in a nutshell.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, then Senate Bill 689 just reestablishes this task force. I think we all agreed that there's plenty more work to be done in a number of areas, and necessitate recreating this task force. And essentially, the bill as it now stands does that. I think we're probably going to have to look at it in terms of potentially using some amendments to make some changes about who's on what the composition of the task force is. I think there are some changes that some people have suggested that make sense. And also just maybe being more specific about the charge of the task force in those areas that we really need to focus on in the next phase of this work. Any of you, if you have any thoughts about that, both in terms of who should be on the task force and what the charge should be, please get in touch with me. Senate Bill 690 is the Certificates of Good Standing bill. It establishes procedures for applying for certificates of good standing, eligibility certification, and for petitioning for and issuing certificate of good standing. The one that, in its current form, as submitted, it works off the bill that Justice DeMunis put in a couple of years ago. But we intend to expand it to include the licensure piece that the Washington law has put into place. And we have some conversations that will be happening with the counties about just how to create the panels, reentry panels to do the evaluation of the portfolios to decide whether a certificate of good standing is warranted or not. Senate Bill 691 is the one related to driving license suspensions. And so the tagline is it eliminates certain driving privilege suspensions. And you'll remember our goal here was to try to limit suspensions to on-road offenses, driving offenses, and not use suspensions as a way to deal with some of the financial issues that are keeping people in a downward spiral. And then finally, Senate Bill 692 is the pre-entry bill, appropriates monies from General Fund to Public Defense Services Commission for pre-entry pilot program. Okay. So all of these bills in this first section, aside from the first two, have not yet been introduced. So if you search for them, you won't find them yet on the on the legislative system. 241 and 242 you will. If you're interested in seeing the concepts for those others, just get in touch with me. And then we have other, and these are bills that came through their own sort of trajectory, not They didn't come through this committee. The first is Senator Frederick's bill that has to do with penalties, fees, and fines, directs Department of Corrections to establish by rule community service exchange program for person to enter into agreement with community-based organization to perform community service in lieu of payment for delinquent fees or debts and supervision fees. Anything?
No, that's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. And then House Bill 2650, I already referenced Representative Doherty's bill related to ban the box on housing applications. House Bill 2724 is a bill that I put in with Representative Kenny Geyer. She's the lead on this bill. And it addresses, in part, an issue that was requested by some of the housing people that spoke to us about creating a state fund to make it that might be a backstop, a kind of insurance program that would make it more likely for landlords to rent to people who are low income or who had criminal records. So what the bill, the catch line is, directs Housing and Community Services Department to develop and implement rent guarantee program to provide incentives and financial assistance to landlords that lease or rent to low-income households by guaranteeing payments to landlords for unpaid rent and for eviction and property damage costs within certain limits. So, anyway, these bills will be entering the system pretty soon. You know, we go into session on February 1st. Some of these bills will go to Senate Judiciary. Others will go to Senate or House Human Services. And a few of them will have subsequent referrals to Ways and Means. Because they'll cost dollars. And I don't need to tell you that's going to be a real challenge this session. You know, at this point, anything that has budget attached to it is going to be a struggle, but it will that will be the story of this session. So with that, any questions about any of these? Yes, Serena.
On the last one, when you're guaranteeing payments to the landlord, is it before they're evicted, or is it to guarantee their payments after they're already out of that place? Or is it to prevent them from getting evicted?
I think it's I think it's a combination. So in some cases, it will be to allow some more leniency on the part of the landlord, and in others, if they have to evict and there are costs attached, you know, for damage and things like that.
I guess I was thinking about the several folks who died just recently from being eviction outside, and there would have been a way to prevent them from getting eviction by making sure that the landlords had some guaranteed payments. So I guess that's all I was thinking about, those homeless folks that died.
It's possible, yeah. I don't know, I'd have to look at the bill closer to be able to answer that, but certainly that's a goal that we'd want to avoid that kind of situation, certainly.
I think it goes along with homelessness, but also with some mental health issues too as well. So it would be nice to see how that would interplay or how it would cross over.
Task force. I believe the bills are accessible. They have been introduced, but they haven't yet been referred.
Okay.
The report will link them, but the link will not be effective until the measure is actually referred to a legislative committee. So you can access the text on OLIS, I believe, and through the report when they're referred, but I think they're available now to look at because they have been introduced.
This bill, yes.
That bill has.
And is there a dollar amount that shows on there as well?
No. It's way too early for that.
Okay.
Yes, Charles.
Just, Senator Bro, just a question about, this may not be related to that last bill, but just in terms of rent control, Is there any talk amongst your colleagues about changing that particular law or ordinance? I'm not sure what it is, but I understand we're not allowed to have rent control in Oregon by some kind of statute.
There's a state preemption on that. That's right. I know that there will be, if there haven't already been, bills that will seek to lift that preemption and leave it up to local jurisdictions to decide how to handle it. And I feel like one or two of them may have been introduced already, but if not, they'll be introduced very early in the session. And yeah, that will be one of the real focuses of debate this session, yeah. I promise. Yeah.
Thank you.
Hold it just a sec, Nova. Paul, did you have a question? I thought I heard you maybe come on.
I was just going to ask about whether electronic copies were available of any of the bills that could be sent out to the task force.
Certainly, we can send out links to those to all the bills that have been introduced, I think we could also send out to the task force members the LCs that. Have been introduced as bills. So the system itself, we can link you into the system, but those that have not yet been actually introduced, although they've been assigned bill numbers, we'll just send you the LCs.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay, great. Other questions about this? Any of these? Oh, I'm sorry, Nova. Yeah.
I was just curious, the last House bill, 2724, you mentioned it's for voting to have an end if they're formally incarcerated, but the text does not say that formally incarcerated, just to make sure, is there somewhere?
I believe that it's there in the bill.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes, it was supposed to.
Okay.
And I saw a write-up in one of the newspapers that said that it applied to people with criminal records, so I think it must be there somewhere.
Ask one more question.
Yeah, sure.
On the last one too, House Bill 27. How will it affect the dollars that the housing already give to community-based organizations to prevent? Is this an add-on or is it just in addition to?
I believe that this is an add-on. I don't believe it's in place of, yeah. Okay, thank you. All right, now for the main bulk of our work today is to finalize the task force report. This is a report that once it's finalized will go out to legislators and be part of the public record. So we want to make sure that it, it really incorporates people's the work that we've done and what people feel ought to be in it. So you have before you and up on the screen the latest iteration of it. I want to, before we get started, just thank Cheyenne very deeply for all the work that went into this. And I find it a very useful document. It will be a very useful document, not only to kind of memorialize the work that we've done as a task force, but also just the way that it frames the issue of the challenges that people with criminal records face. So having said that, let's go through and take a look at the changes from the last iteration. I want to thank everyone who sent in comments or requests for changes. They have been incorporated into this document. And let me turn it over to Cheyenne then.
Mr. Chair, members of the task force, I also sent out a usually when I'm more timely with the documents, I've sent out just now a narrative via email describing the changes and wanted to walk through them page by page. The previous iteration of this report that was sent out on December 30th, this report, the copy you have available there and the one we're looking at on screen, incorporates everything that was in the report that was sent out, the draft report from the 30th. And between then and right up till today, all the changes everybody has sent in or suggested that I could fit in there. Some were conceptual and some were very specific, and I've done the best I can. You won't offend me if I haven't captured your requested change in a way that satisfies you. Just let me know. We're just rolling with it. So on page one, the executive summary, that's just a date change to today's date. Page two, also throughout, replacing the descriptor ex-offender with other descriptors, and that was Commissioner Carlson's suggestion. So everywhere ex-offender appeared, there are a number of changes just to change that language. Page two duplicates changes that are made later in the report at pages 14 and 15. The findings and recommendations sections are merely copied here, so we'll get to those later. Page four, Jen has a new title, so that's in the report. Thank you. And I'm far enough away that the mouse is not keeping up with the scrolling as I would like. So I beg your patience. That's the new title. And then you can see individuals with criminal histories replacing ex-offenders. That occurs in a lot of different places. Or just the word person, or just the word individual rather than ex-offender. Page five, I've included a note that some information has been received outside of task force meetings. We model after legislative process and try to do everything on the record, but it's a little bit looser with task force. We do sometimes get information from folks outside of these meetings. Just wanted to make sure that was accurate in the report. Page six is a suggestion from Chair Denbrough to include a note about the approach that the task force agreed to at the outset, which was basically chronological. So that sentence is making note of that chronological approach that you all followed. Also, here's one I wasn't certain about. Jen Netherwood pointed out that there was inaccurate language here with regard to the description of crew. I've deleted that, but that may not be, maybe you wanted to change a few words. I wasn't sure, but I went ahead and deleted the stuff that you said was not accurate.
Now it needs to be deleted until I can get some follow-up information from Coffee Creek.
Actually, let me ask, since we have Marie, you're here, what is the status of crew as you understand it? Could you come up, Marie? Sorry to put you on the spot. Yeah.
Should you get for coming to the meeting?
Or Cindy, whoever. Great.
Chair, members of the task force, with respect to crew, I haven't, last I heard, there was an open announcement, a job announcement for it, and it was a failed recruitment. So that was the latest that I had heard about the crew program. So I know they've set up an area for the program there at Coffee Creek, but they will need funding for the program. And again, the college will also need to do another recruitment.
So the funding is not in place. I thought it was in place prior to the first recruit.
They will need additional funding for the program.
That to bump the salary, to attract a candidate, or to?
I really don't know. I don't know the reasoning behind the failed recruitment. I know they had two applicants who were not interested in the position.
And I know one turned down based on salary. She couldn't afford to take the pay cut, so.
So is that the issue with the needing more funding?
No, the biggest issue is the failed recruitment.
Okay.
Yes.
And are you coming to the legislature for a request for more funding, or this is within the DOC budget?
I cannot speak to that. That's higher than I am. That'd be an assistant director or higher question.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Marie. Okay, great.
I'll follow
yes,
up more.
Jen.
Keep scrolling down. Page 8 is the next change where included. Chair Dembro's suggestion, just the stance that DAS was open to opportunities to implement same practices or practices that were consistent with same principles. That's the state as model employer practices. Also on page 8 and 9, these three paragraphs Jim Booker provided about the services provided by the Oregon Employment Department. So they were just lifted in total, Jim, and put into the report.
About the tax credit and
correct.
The other, yeah.
And could I just note, because I saw that it still has like ex-felons and ex-offenders in it, would you be open to following the same
yeah.
kind of language?
Yeah, I wrote that before. Yeah, I knew we were doing that. So.
Scrolling down here at 9 and 10, there was a general suggestion from Commissioner Carlson to beef up or emphasize child support in particular as a piece of the discussion about the debt burden. So anywhere that that came up, I broke it out to direct and indirect impacts, financial impacts of criminal conduct, beefed up the description. Everyone should probably take a moment to read that in an effort to try to emphasize and draw more attention and give it more treatment.
Shane, let
and
me
this
just...
this is one of those places.
Okay, let me jump in just because I happen to notice in the section about the disparate impact, one of the things that we heard about when we had our first presentation on housing was the burden of obtaining multiple background checks. And there is a bill out there. I don't know whose bill it is.
It's a House bill, I believe.
It's a House bill.
Maybe Alyssa Kinnegeyer.
I think maybe I signed on to it. Anyway, we're in that strange time now where everything's kind of up in the air. But it would say that landlords that have multiple listings would be limited to one background check for all of the listings. Hey, somebody's off mute. Could you go back on? I'm hearing some interesting instruments there. thanks. So this would require that, you know, if you have a landlord that has a number of different properties, that the individual would not have to seek a background check for every one of the properties that they were applying for. And so I'm hoping we'll have progress on that at least.
Just trying to make a change there while you were talking. So scrolling past, slightly beefed up treatment of with regard to debt and child support. Pages 13 and 14 we just looked at where the current status as of the writing of this report of the various concepts appears. And there was one additional bill that came up in a search when I looked for the search term reentry, which I added to the ones that were previously described. And that was House Bill 2249. It's a Department of Corrections bill supplementing the funding for counties for particular programs for persons under 25. And again, when the links are active in the report, you can go straight to the measure history and the text of the bill and get the information. And then in the findings and recommendations section. Again, just emphasizing the finding regarding debt, I moved it up to the third to here, just a cut and paste, removing it from lower in the list. Again, that was Commissioner Carlson's suggestion. On page 15, also reordered a couple suggestions from Chair Dembro to reorder so greater emphasis was at the top of the list, roughly. And then page 16, again, where debt and came up as part of the recommendations section, beefed it up, mentioned child support in particular. At page 18, a paragraph has been added about the Children's Bill of Rights, and there was language, Chair Dembro, pending about the status of conversations with HEC that they are currently looking into.
Right.
But that was it after the description of the Bill of Rights there. Yeah. And there are a few links in the appendix pending hyperlinking, and the please don't be concerned about pagination, things like that. That will all straighten out after any other editing is done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So going back, we had the presentation from Corrections Industries, and Jen, we lost Jen. All right, I'll come back to that. Jen had some questions, so we'll come back to it when she comes back in. We had the report from the University of Oregon on the question that they ask of people coming in about their criminal history.
And that's on page 7, sorry for the interruption, sir.
Okay.
Page 7.
Yeah. Paul, is that you? Did you have a question?
I did not have a question.
Okay. Okay, I think we're all on mute now. On page 7, we had a presentation from the University of Oregon about their admission process, where they asked for applicants' disciplinary criminal histories, just to reiterate, they feel the need to be delving into that question because applicants are potentially going to live on campus, living in dorms, and there's concern about the safety of other students, they received some tough questioning, I think, from the committee about whether or not that was really necessary that they do that. University of Oregon is kind of out there ahead of where the other NCAA schools are, or the Pac-12 schools, and the other schools in the country. The other schools in the state, sorry. And I did a follow-up with them, asked if subsequent to their meeting with us, if they were contemplating any changes based on that meeting. And they said they were not. They're waiting to hear what the task force is recommending. Ask you all if this is an issue that is still of concern to you, whether or not the University of Oregon should be asking about criminal history as well as disciplinary history. And remember, that includes suspensions while in high school and things that didn't necessarily rise to the level of criminal history. Is that something that task force members feel the university should still be working on? I appreciate your feedback on that.
Well, I think it is something we should be working on, quite frankly, because I think that's one of the areas that I keep I keep hearing from both students and parents. Trying to figure out how they can deal with some of those issues. So yes, I do.
Especially around the rape cases.
Well, yeah.
Popped up and not knowing if there's going to be issue. And I think that's not just U of O, but I think there's several campuses that need to be worried about those issues. So.
Paul, were you on?
Yeah, I absolutely think this is an issue that the task force should continue to monitor, and to the extent that we can, push the University of Oregon to reconsider the policy, since they have met with us. A number of universities around the country have changed their policies around this very issue. So I think it's timely, and it's an opportunity for us to continue to engage them to take a more progressive approach. So I would love to see this on our agenda for the future.
Mr. Chair, should I add a recommendation in the recommendation section?
I think so. I think that makes sense. Everybody agree with that? That great. Okay, Jen, just when you slipped out, I was getting to the issue of the prison industries. And you had some questions about getting information broken down by occupation or something. So
That's correct.
Yeah. So, and could our prison industry, I forgot your first name. Ben, could you come up? Thanks.
Mr. Chair, members of the task force, that's correct. Among the suggestions that Jen made was, and I wasn't sure how to capture it, so there wasn't anything that triggered me, because nothing was added to the report about breaking out the data, comparing programs for men versus women.
You know, when I wrote that, I wondered if this was a bigger concept to look at. It's not just looking at within what is being offered in Oregon Corrections Enterprises, but what we as a state are offering incarcerated inmates, both male and female, in terms of opportunities while incarcerated to take steps forward in some kind of a career move. So breaking that down by what are we offering to women in the women's prisons and what are we offering to men in terms of the types of programs, not just the, I'm not looking for percentages and numbers, but just.
Paul?
Okay, so Paul, are you talking to us?
Oh, sorry, my bad.
Okay. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah, go on, Jen.
Just not looking at numbers of inmates served just because of the vast difference in the number of women we incarcerate and the number of men incarcerated, but just the types of opportunities being offered to our men in our men's prisons and our women in our single women's prison. And I'm not sure if it needs to be included in this report or if this is something that rolls forward and goes with the work of the task force. Should we be continued? So I don't have a specific question for OCE at this point. I think this is just something that I realized in reading that paragraph, I believe, should be broken out, and we need to start looking at what we're offering to men and women in terms of the types of programming. That's all.
I mean, one of the subjects, the issues that came up when we had that presentation, and yeah, I think it was part of that presentation, was the question, the issue of transferability of work experience, and you know, a challenge of, you know, how the proficiencies that are gained while inside can translate into certification outside, and you know, with those programs that are part of the licensed apprenticeship program, that's obviously not a problem, but that I think we heard from our member from Eastern Oregon, you know, from Eddie Alves, that you know, sometimes people have problems transferring because the local community college maybe doesn't have that particular program, and how can we make it easier for the person post-release to be on a pathway to certification. I don't know if you have anything to add.
We're looking at for the female population. We actually have a couple new programs that we're looking at. Transcription services and some other stuff at Coffee Creek. As far as the real world, we offer all kinds of laundries, furniture factory. I'm sure you know about a lot of our programs. The certifications, some are more valid than the others. The BOLI certifications are great. They also are hard to get and aren't as easy to offer. We do a lot of our own programming, and we give out a 6-month or a year-long programs. We offer testing. We do soft skills at the end. They've got to go through soft skills to get their certificate, and it means a lot to these guys. It doesn't mean a lot to the employers sometimes, but the fact that they have a certificate and they have the confidence is really going along, and the skills they've learned throughout the process of gaining the certificate and the training and the whole on the job deal. So,
And I think, you know, one of the to-dos recommendations from, you know, at least for me from this task force is to try to get that experience more recognized outside and to figure out a way to make that happen so that those proficiencies actually can translate into something that employers will recognize. And that's, you know, that's a task, I think, for our workforce development, higher education coordinating commission operation to really address.
It is, and some people, frankly, don't care. I spoke with a welding, with a metal fab person in Salem recently about, I stopped from our Mill Creek farm operation, stopped at a manufacturer in Salem. The guy didn't care. He didn't care at all about a certificate. What he said was, you bring him here, I'll talk to them, and I'm going to give them a test. And if they can weld, they're fine. So to him, the certificate literally meant nothing. He was going to test them. And so it's great, it's good, but also just that real work experience is also going a long way. And we have about 1,400 people for OCE alone now, as well as a lot more for Department of Corrections, but trying to offer that training and skill. And all those certificates, great. Bully's great. Also, just keeping them working and teaching those life skills is good, too.
If they get a certificate of good standing, it'll be even better.
Well, when we give them that certificate, we also, how many hours they worked, and we have a review of what they've done. So we try to give them all as much as we can to take out with them. And the certificate, although it may not be BOLI certified or whatever, it's still a valid a year-long program. And so we try to give them everything we can, do as much as we can there.
Yes, Janet?
I had a question. So you were saying that there's some barriers in terms of with BOLI in terms of getting those certificates. I'm just thinking back to 2011 when I think it was Kevin Cameron, when he was legislator, worked with me on a bill, and we were looking for actually enhancing the good time that people serve, like getting a reduction in the time they had to serve based on education programs inside. And then Bob Shiprack actually approached me and said, can we add apprenticeships and trades and not just make it college education? And so that's how the bill came out. And in discussions with Bob, he seemed to think that the trades would have, and I'm looking at Jen because I don't know if you're connected with these folks, but I'm assuming you are, that they would have a real interest in helping out. So kind of where's the disconnect when you're saying that you offer, you know, you're offering things, but they aren't the same certificates and they're not accepted and all that? I'm not getting that.
Well, for starters, we started out with, before the BOLI piece came to us, which we borrowed from the Department of Corrections, we've had a laundry program, furniture factory. We've got several different programs that we developed on our own. When it comes to the BOLI stuff, they're very strict about the amount of staff. In fact, in a metal shop, we can only have 4 in our BOLI program because they have real strict requirements. They have to have 2,000 hours. So some of that is limited just the size of the shop and the amount of supervisors in the shop. And I don't mean to say that our programming isn't good. It's just it's what we've had. And we're going to keep it in place. We're not going to throw it away, but we're trying to find better stuff as well. And everybody wants a. When we started the BOLI certificate, all the guys and some of the females who want to be in that program because it's got more. It's a better certificate at the end, and we can't blame them. They really like that, but we're also not going to turn our back on the programs we've had going for years. I'm not sure I answered your question.
No. Well, it's a project.
Yeah. Probably needs to have more conversation.
Jules, did you have a question?
It's kind of not so much on this issue, but I just came back from a conference, and parole and probation conference, and talking about women's issues. And that just maybe a future concept for us to look at is the unique needs of women in terms of reentry and services, because nationally they're seeing a huge influx of women in the prison system, and it's not just Oregon. So I think it might be a good area for us to look into.
Right. Okay, thanks a lot. Anything in the report that you have questions about or you think needs further work? You can see the appendices are really very impressive. I mean, it's a lot there. I believe that this document can be a real resource to people because of all these links. Paul, do you have anything to add to it?
No, I think it was well done. I appreciate all the work that Cheyenne and everybody else put into it, and I am good with what we have ready to go.
Okay. All right, then. I'm going to entertain a motion to accept the report with the changes that we've already talked about. You know, Cheyenne will be fine-tuning it, but...
And, Mr. Chair, while the task force was talking, if you were watching, I'm trying to capture the discussion. It could be refined, but the language to examine it, the public university admissions practices, to understand and improve the disparities between opportunities for men versus women and translating proficiencies from training and educational opportunities to real-world opportunities, and then reentry needs that may be unique to women is what's been added to the recommendations to carry forward for the task force to continue, that it should continue to work.
Okay, I think we should give Cheyenne a certificate of multitasking.
Let's hope it's a Bowley one.
So yeah, it'll be Bowley recognized. Okay, so,
well,
yes.
I would move that we accept the report with the changes that we've discussed.
Yeah. All right. It's moved and seconded that we accept the report as modified. Any discussion? Okay. Is there any objection to this motion? Okay. Seeing none, the report is adopted. So it'll get cleaned up, and then it will be forwarded out to legislators and be part of the public record. At this point, we have what I hope will be Reentry Task Force 1 will have exhausted its charge. Yes, Commissioner.
I didn't want to interrupt you. I just wanted to say that the Marion County Public Safety Coordinating Council is one of 36 public safety councils in Oregon, correct? And I'm the chair of the council in Marion County. We started 2 years ago doing a legislative agenda on public safety related issues. And so this year we're putting that agenda together. We've seen a draft and we'll approve it at our February meeting. And then we have a roundtable briefing that we've scheduled through Senator Courtney's office in room 350 for our legislative delegation. And we would like to include all of the bills of the task force along with the report in that legislative agenda for support so that we can present them to our legislative delegation. So I just wanted to let you know that we're doing that. And if there are other counties or communities, the public safety councils, and I'm looking at Ross because his office has connections with them, that might be another way for us to get the word out rather than just us as task force members, but going through our organizations to gain grassroots support for what we're doing here.
I think that's great. And, you know, something, you know, I will say that I want to talk to you about is strategies for the certificates of good standing. You know, since so much of that work will be county-based, at least currently the way the bill is designed, it envisions reentry councils in, at least in those counties that want to do it, that want to set up separate reentry councils, and just to get a sense of how we can make sure that counties are interested in that or committed to that, how we could make it easier to actually implement for them, you know, et cetera. So I hope you'll be willing to be part of that conversation. Great. I want to thank you all for being part of this. And if you're still waiting for your paycheck to come in the mail, I really urge your ongoing patience. But I know you've given a lot of time and attention, really appreciate it. And I want to really, thank the members of the public that have been following this, the representatives from the agencies. Your expertise and input has really been valuable. So please stay in touch with, me and with the process. Every one of these bills that are going to be going through the process this session, you can follow. Just go onto the legislative website, go to the page. Each of these bills will have its own page. Click on follow this bill, and any action that is contemplated for the bill, you'll get an email notification of it. It's a great way to stay on top of things as the bill is being amended, as it's referred to committee, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is an ongoing process.
Materials and letters that are sent in are all part of that too, so you get a chance to see what's going on and who's sending what in. It's a really incredible sort of process. So,
right. And some of these bills I know are of particular interest to some of you. And so if you would consider also making yourself available to testify for public hearings or send in support materials, give us your perspective, that would be great. And so, as I promised, I'll send out the LCs for those that are not on the public record yet, and any suggestions that you have about amendments would be very welcome. Okay. So with that, thanks again to Cheyenne for all her work supporting us, and to Zoe, who preceded her, but who school was just irresistible
to
her.
Abandoned us.
Yes. I want to thank you. And okay, so with that, I'm adjourning this meeting, and this task force's work is adjourned for now.